Blog Talk Radio.
With another broadcast of This Week in Health Innovation. I'm Greg Masters, your producer and co-host of the show, and we are brought to you by the healthinnovationmedia.com. And we're excited today. We have a guest on the show, and of course, we being myself and Dr. Pat Salver, and I just want to make sure that Pat is with me in the virtual booth. You can never make any assumptions these days on Skype. Pat, are you with us?
Still here.
Still hear it loud and clear. That's great. So I'm stoked today. We have a guest on our show who is a friend of this broadcast as well as of yours and mine, Pat. He's a prolific and thoughtful writer, blogger, and consultant, and has recently penned the title Still Demanding Medical Excellence, which is posted on the healthcare blog. It's somewhat of a pulse check on the status of the quality movement since the IOM's landmark publication, Crossing the Quality Chasm, in 2001. Michael is on Twitter. You can follow him at MLMILLENSON, ML Millinson. And he describes himself as a quality of care evangelist by his consulting, writing, and speaking. And he's an early, local, loud, and effective, I might add, advocate for better, safer, patient-centered care. So with that as a very brief and understated introduction to Michael Millinson, Pat, over to you. Help us get to know Michael.
Sure. Fantastic. Michael, it's so much fun to be able to talk to you on the radio, and glad that we had a chance to see each other at Health 2.0. You know, it's been, if I did my math right, 16 years since you wrote Demanding Medical Excellence, where you were a loud voice pointing out the problems that we have with quality and healthcare. Back in the day, you know, now people talk about it a lot. Back in those days, that was when we were still saying we had the best healthcare in the world, and here was Michael Millinson saying, hey, you know, maybe not. So it's been 16 years. What's happened in that time? Have we? I know you're still demanding medical excellence, but have we fixed the problem?
Well, first of all, it's always a pleasure to be chatting with you, Pat, and with Greg, and you've both been fighting the good fight. When I wrote Demanding Medical Excellence, it was a very destabilizing experience. I went into it planning on writing a book about all the good things the doctors and hospitals were doing using information technology to change medicine for the better. And the more I dug into the medical literature, the more I went onto the front lines of care, the more I interviewed doctors and nurses and researchers and others, the more I found all these problems that kind of folks knew about but kept under wraps. So nobody spoke about medical error and its consequences. And I started doing a little bit of the math on the studies and found that we were killing around 180,000 people from preventable deaths in hospitals every year. The idea that doctors were not following the medical literature, that really they were kind of doing what they learned in med school as opposed to what the latest studies showed, that was a brand new idea that was called evidence-based medicine and, again, was very unsettling to people to find that out. And, of course, the fact that doctors did not necessarily include patients in their decisions, were very slow to adopt technology, all of those ideas were very unsettling and not something talked about in public. We've made progress, and we can talk about that, but probably the greatest progress we've made is now we can at least acknowledge that the problems exist.
Can I interrupt for a second?
Sure.
Michael, I just want to interrupt for a second. And I'm thinking back to my training, and I think part of the problem that we had was that we didn't put the proper name on things. We would have a disaster that happened as a result of, say, an intervention or procedure we were doing, and we called that you know, the part of the complication, right? I mean, it was expected that 10% of people would have this happen to them. So you didn't look at it as a problem. You'd say, oh, well, yeah, 10% of people are going to have that happen to them. We know that, right? And so there was a naming problem, right? We weren't calling it out as quality. We were calling it out as that's the complication, right?
And Pat, I know that you are much too young to have trained back in the 1950s, which is when they first started writing about this, and yet that's exactly what the attitude is. You'd see articles that went back to 1956, I remember this, and it was called, the article was called The Hazards of Modern Medicine. And basically we would summarize what it said as stuff happens, right? Medicine's dangerous and stuff happens. And that attitude really continued all the way up to 1995, when the Boston Globe did a story about how one of its medical columnists had been killed by an error while being treated for breast cancer by one of the best cancer hospitals in the country. Nobody paid any attention when she said something didn't feel right. They'd been giving her a 10 times overdose of a drug. And that page one story and really the Harvard community turning inwards and saying, really, we need to look at this differently, changed things. And the AMA, the American Medical Association, wrote a letter to Dear Abby back then that says exactly what, kind of what you were saying, Pat, which is, well, there's millions of encounters every year with doctors, and unfortunately some things go wrong, and then changed its mind and started to say, no, you know, we're going to really look at this. So that attitude of, well, things happen, took a long time to change.
And so now we name it, now we talk about it, now we measure it, now we study it. Have we made any progress? I know with respect to death, when the Institute of Medicine report came out and said what it was like 180,000 deaths each year due
to medical errors. Now they said 44,000 to 98,000. I had done a little different methodology, but yes, they came out with 44 to 98,000 preventable deaths every year in hospitals alone, and a million injuries. The interesting thing is when they came out with that number, the healthcare industry was all indignant. And now, years later, people are coming up with higher numbers, and the response of the healthcare industry is, no, those higher numbers aren't right. The Institute of Medicine is right.
Yeah, it's pretty
funny.
We
are making progress.
So whether it's 200,000, 250,000, or 98,000, still a lot of people dying
as
self-preventable medical errors. So
We are making progress, but very slowly. And frankly, my suspicion is that the progress we've been making is really in the last 3 or 4 years much more quickly than in the 10 years or 12 years before that. If you take a look at all the studies, they show that we haven't made much progress, save the latest numbers being 2010, 2011, which is shocking. You know, an entire decade is this headline study by the best and brightest of medicine. On the other hand, there are some indications we're doing that now. I wrote a blog for Health Affairs a few years ago called Why We Still Kill Patients in Visibility, Inertia, and Income. And quite frankly, medical complications have been profitable. I'm not saying that anybody deliberately hurts people. They don't. But sometimes when you prioritize, you don't prioritize on stopping things that make you money. When Medicare in 2008 started the process of not paying for certain preventable medical mistakes that they called never events, that started hospitals towards changing their policies. And you know, Pat, you talked about naming things. Think about the difference between having an iatrogenic illness and a never event.
Well,
captures your attention.
You want me to think about
we are making progress slowly in safety. One of the things, though, by the way, that surprised me, and I think will surprise others, is we've had a lot of attention appropriately on the hospital, but of course, healthcare has been moving to outpatient surgery centers and outpatient all sorts of things for many, many years, we have no definitive data on injuries and deaths caused by medical error outside the hospital. No definitive data all these years after the Institute of Medicine's error report.
So what you're suggesting is that the number could be much higher than this high number that we're already talking about.
Sure, the total number, absolutely. I guess, unless you want to believe that no one is killed accidentally in an outpatient environment, I guess that's a touching belief.
So I still am trying to get to, give me some examples of things that have improved, because it kind of feels like a lot of doom and gloom, we're doing bad and we continue to do bad.
Sure. So what's improved? And what's improved is, first of all, you in the safety area, you do have a lot of regulations, a lot of rules, and a lot of people who've moved up over the years who are a little more committed to this. So we're starting to get an infrastructure in place for safer care. And in particular, we're starting to address some of the high-impact problems, central line-associated bloodstream infections. We're taking on some big things that are really dangerous, and that's good. The other place where we're and we have some institutions, frankly, which have shown that you can dramatically reduce harm. We have real live examples, not a lot of them, but we have at least role models, which we never had before. So you have new rules, you have new role models. You're also seeing, I think, in healthcare, an acceptance of quality improvement in a way that wasn't true before. People now realize that there is room for improvement. There have been so many studies, so many articles out there, and so we're starting to see an acceptance of that. So I think the culture is changing to accept that these kinds of things are necessary, in part of the reason, quite frankly, is that when you go 20 years down the road from when people first started talking about it, you've had 20 years worth of people who resisted it retiring. And so someone who might have been a young Turk talking about quality and safety 20 years ago, if they stay with it in 20 years, they get to head up the institution. So we've had turnover, and that helps. So I think, I wrote a blog post a couple of years ago after my wife had a bicycle accident, how three hospitals didn't harm my wife. And she had a bike accident in Maine and went to a small hospital there, then went to a very, very large and famous teaching hospital in Boston, and then flew home and had surgery at a big suburban hospital here where I live outside Chicago. And in all three cases, people were pretty good about safety. I spoke up quite a bit, but people were pretty good about safety. Would it have been exactly the same if I hadn't spoken up? Maybe, maybe not. But, we have not certainly reached a point where if you have a loved one in a hospital, you need to keep your wits about you and be an advocate. We have not reached a point where that isn't important.
And maybe it is the most important thing. I'm just finishing up the biography of Steve Jobs, and when he got really sick post his liver transplant, his wife sat at the bedside and evidently reviewed everything and made spreadsheets and trend lines and quizzed the doctors. Basically served as his advocate. Maybe that's what
absolutely.
We all need.
I don't think if you know this well, anybody who's in healthcare, whether they're a physician or non-physician, if you ask them, would you go into the hospital, even the best hospital that you know, maybe even one where you work, without someone to act as your advocate, I don't think anyone you know would answer that question. Sure, doesn't matter at all. You need someone to keep track and to be an advocate.
Yeah, so it's very interesting. Years ago, I did some volunteer work in Guatemala, and there was a hospital run by a missionary, and he did two things that kind of shocked me. I was, I think, a second year medical student at the time and used to our system, and I go down there, and first of all, the family was at the bedside feeding the patient, bathing the patient, basically doing the nursing care, and watching over what was going on. So they were doing family-based patient advocacy, back when we were saying, you know, visiting hours are over. You need to go home and leave the patient by themselves. The other thing that he did, which was really interesting, was he made the family or the patient responsible for their medical records. So they all had cards that had their medical record on it, and they carried it with them. And we're just now getting to the point where we say, hey, patients ought to have access to their records. Guess what? Maybe there's mistakes in the records. And if you let the patient look at it, they can say, you know, I never had that diagnosis, or you got this wrong, or I'm not actually taking that medication. So it's pretty funny that there's actually some lessons from the developing world that we're only now catching up with, which leads me to my next question, Michael. That was a soliloquy, but leading me to my next question, which is, how do we compare to other countries? Are there any countries out there that have this quality and safety thing right?
You know, the Scandinavian countries are a little better than we are on all of this, particularly in some of the quality improvement being part of the mainstream. Ironically, it's sort of better when you're in a government-run system, and one of the reasons is because then you have someone that the news media and the politicians can blame. Right, so if you have patient safety here problems, there's so many different hospitals, and hospitals are important to the community, and you know there's no real person to put the blame on, and it's not public. Whereas if it's a government finance system, you just accuse the government of messing things up, and then there's some sort of centralized initiative. It's sort of amusing in its own way, but I don't think anybody is head and shoulders above us in solving the issue, because it is a cultural one. It is a one where physicians have to first acknowledge that these are not people who would have died anyway or would have been hurt anyway or is all unavoidable. The same thing with quality improvement. You know, you mentioned, I just want to go back to something you mentioned about Guatemala, Pat, having the patients by the bedside, the family, and having certain responsibilities. I wrote a white paper on patient-centered care, and one of the interesting initiatives is being done by the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center in the orthopedic surgery department by a physician, an orthopedic surgeon, Dr. Tony DeGoya, who trained as an engineer originally and is very process-oriented, and has a whole patient- and family-centered care methodology. Well, one of the things he does is he insists before anybody gets a procedure, a hip replacement or some sort of other orthopedic procedure, that an advocate who's going to be their advocate, who's going to be their person who helps them out after surgery, comes to the hospital with that person beforehand, and they go through an orientation session on what the surgery is going to be like, what you're going to have to do to help with the recuperation, and all the rest of the things that are involved. That kind of reaching out to family or significant other or whatever as team members that play a role in recovery, that's really important, and I think that's where we're going to be going. So those kind of patient-centered, collaborative, partnership things, those are starting to happen also, and it's culturally difficult here. We're not Guatemala. But it's something that I think will make care better for patients. And you know what? At the end of the day, the clinicians are actually going to find it's better for them also.
Yeah, it's interesting. It does take more time. It means you actually have to stop and talk to people and explain things. But after all, when this person goes home, is the house prepared? You know, does everybody in the family understand what the do's and the don'ts are? You know, and a lot of times the patient, you know, may be in denial or maybe doesn't completely understand or maybe incapacitated because of medications.
Sure.
And if there isn't a second opinion there, you know, they really aren't going to know what to do. I want to shift gears a little bit because you and I were both just at Health 2.0 and all the buzz and the excitement around mHealth and gizmos and gadgets, and you know, the telephone is your ancillary healthcare provider. Is this going to make any difference? Do you think that this is going to be the intervention or the innovation that actually ends up making an improvement in quality and safety?
What's so exciting about healthcare information on the internet, and particularly the kind of Health 2.0 information, which is interactive, is that it represents a shattering of the monopoly on actionable information by the professional class. You know, I call my book Demanding Medical Excellence, Doctors and Accountability in the Information Age. And the information age, the ability to measure and manage what we're doing and to look at its results, is what's ultimately going to improve quality. Part of that, and a very, very important part, is done by clinicians and really has nothing to do with the patient. But that accountability thing is often the responsibility of the patient. With a mobile health application, I can start looking at information on my diagnosis, information on my treatment, and information on the competence and quality of my clinician team on my phone, in the doctor's office, in the waiting room, in the exam room, in real time. I can look at it on my way there. I can check out things. It starts to provide an equality of information in some ways, obviously not in all ways, that changes everything, that changes the power structure, that changes the accountability structure. And that is a pretty radical change. And at Health 2.0, you could see that the applications, the software, the kinds of things that enable that information exchange to be on more equal terms, we're starting to get there. That's an enormously important development.
Yeah, it's very interesting. We tend to exist in a bubble. You know, we hang out with the Health 2.0 people. You know, I hang out with a lot of healthcare entrepreneurs. And yet this morning I read a story about somebody who attended a more traditional medical meeting, the MGMA meeting, and commented that they're really, you know, none of this kind of mHealth, mobile health, health IT was really playing a big presence at that meeting. It was much more focused on practice management and kind of more traditional approaches to healthcare. And I found that at other types of medical meetings as well. And there seems to be kind of this a dichotomy between all this cool stuff that's going on in the health tech world and then all the stuff that's still going on in the more traditional insurance system, delivery system world.
Well, part of the problem, of course, is that the average patient in the hospital is not a 24-year-old Asian-American male who lives in Palo Alto. People
oh,
who
really?
Are sick, yes, and orders burritos via the internet, and is engaged in fitness contests with his friends via Facebook and mobile app. I'm all in love with that kind of stuff. But people who are sick tend to be older. They tend to be lower socioeconomic often. Because they are sick, they're sometimes not really in a mood to try anything new. They may have kids or they may have friends to help them. And so the dissemination of all these kinds of things is much slower into the real population. And at Health 2.0, one of the highlights, as it were, was when Susanna Fox of the Pew Internet Research Center talked about the fact that 70% of people track their health, but most of them use paper and pencil. So I think that you're right to inject a note of caution here. Fitness apps are much more likely to catch on than sickness apps. But again, having said that, even if it's not mobile, the fact that the information is available, that you can check it on your home, on your PC, or your iPad before you leave for your doctor's appointment, is going to start to have an effect. And one of the other things that either slows it down or speeds it up is the consolidation of the medical field. So if your doctor would have been someone who would respond to you or adopt something when you talk to him, but now his practice is owned by a mega health system, he's going to be slower. If the mega health system is fast and he would have been slow, he's going to be faster. So it's tough to disseminate new technology, but everybody doesn't have to use it for there to be a tipping point. One of the things, and it's not necessarily mobile, but it's really important, is the Patients Like Me site, which is a very well-established now community of patients with a lot of illnesses, trading information on what works for them in terms of drugs and other therapies on some very difficult chronic diseases. That kind of community starts to be a real counterweight to, trust me, I've seen six patients like you in the last year and I know what's going to happen, advice you're getting from your doctor. So I think sometimes the impact of information age kinds of medicine on clinical practice may not be as visible. And besides, the people at the MGAMA meeting may be most interested in billing software. That's why they came there.
Well, that's a good point. And so you're kind of bringing up this idea of community, and we had an opportunity to talk to Fred Goldstein at Health 2.0.
Sure.
We did a nice interview with him. And he is, as is Esther Dyson and a number of other people, have started looking at the community, the local community, your city, your county, as the place where health and wellness is really going to be driven and supported. And first of all, I want to know if you agree, and second, I want to know if this is an area that you have interest in, and could this impact of community on health and wellness actually play a role in quality and injury prevention?
Absolutely. I've talked to Fred about this, and actually 7 or 8 years ago, I came up with a concept that maybe was too far ahead of its time and now will not be, called stewardship care. And it was based on a quote from Cardinal Bernardin of Chicago, like Cardinal Bernardin, who, when he was sick with cancer in 1996, said, you know, we don't have enough resources to go around, but rather than talking about rationing, we need to talk about stewardship. And stewardship is when you go to folks, and instead of talking in our wonk talk about value-based this and cost-based that and effective and efficient, which are very, very cold words, you say, you know what, how can we be good stewards of limited resources? What can our community do? And maybe if the community cooperates and collaborates, maybe it gets something back. So maybe rather than that savings from the patient-centered medical home or the accountable care organization, maybe all that shared savings, instead of going back to insurance companies and medical groups and hospitals, maybe some of that's shared with the community. Maybe it goes to child care. Maybe it goes to baby care. Maybe it goes to education. Maybe it goes to build roads. Whatever the community wants, but that kind of shared responsibility, shared reward is really something that we need, because I think we've shown that top-down revolutions don't work too well in healthcare. We need people to be with us, not looking at us skeptically.
Yeah, and I think the power of this is, if I think about my community, I could have an impact on Larkspur, California. I can't necessarily have an impact on the entire United States or even the whole state of California. So if we had a system set up where I could work to make a difference and know that the money would come back to the community and we could pave the road or put the stop sign in or the stoplight at the place where there's been, you know, the most fender benders, or, you know, pay to bring a neurosurgeon into the local hospital where that's been kind of a persistent problem in my community. I think you could get people engaged, right? I mean, because they could
absolutely
feel and benefit, right, from the – so maybe this really is the – quality, I like you use the word revolution, but the quality revolution that we've
to close the loop for a moment, some of the mobile health and other tools that you're talking about could be underlying enablers that allow the professionals and the public to work more as collaborators, that rather than the tools being seen as something where it's adversarial, it's something that's collaborative and allows all of us to collaborate in our community together. I mean, that would be my hope.
Right. No, that's great. And there was one program or application that was at Health 2.0 that really caught my attention and I think has local relevance, which was believe it was called ESRI, E-S-R-I, where the person introduced the idea of geomedicine. Hey, you know what? If I saw that plant that was producing toxins was actually in my neighborhood and I knew about it and I could see the impact, you betcha that I'd go over and try and do something about it. I may not try and do something about it if it's in your neighborhood.
Absolutely. And there's also some mapping that have done that have shown hospitals in your neighborhood with the quality rankings making the hospital dot green or yellow or red. So I think you're right. And there was another application there. There was somebody called Mana Health that had won a New York eHealth Collaborative grant. And what I thought was interesting about them is they were very easy to use. Right, good interface. So that's where we're going. We're going to talk to average people and make sense to average people about what happens in my community, and that's really terrific.
Well, that's great. So, Michael, I hear our closing music. I'm going to ask you to sum up in one word. How do you feel about quality going forward? Hopeful, pessimistic, neutral? What's the word?
I feel hopeful. But I would say that I'm not quite sure how soon hopeful is going to come to pass. It will, but I've been a little bit wrong before. But I am hopeful.
Okay, so hopeful, comma, fun.
So there you have
right.
it.
Good.
We're going to end on a positive note. Where the word is hopeful from Michael Millenson, consultant, lecturer, author in the healthcare space. Check him out on the web. That's Millenson.com. Follow him on Twitter at MLMillenson. And we do this weekly on This Week in Health Innovation. Join us next week on This Week in Health Innovation for a yet-to-be-confirmed interview, but it'll be a good one. So this is Greg Masters for Pat Solver saying thanks for joining us, and we will see you on the backside. Bye now.
That was never, never